Well, good morning, everyone. I'm Trevor. I'm the associate pastor here, and I kind of got a little bit of an allergy or something going on, so I can't talk too loud today. So my apologies, because if I talk louder, I'm going to be hacking up a lung up here. So is anyone here someone who really likes to have control of things? Yeah, a few hands go up. Do you just need to have it for everything to feel okay? Yeah, maybe you're the type of guy that people naturally look to as a leader, like as a guide for things. Or maybe you're the woman who's always in the fray of it, right? Knowing what to do, how to direct others. Maybe you're the one in your home that handles the finances, or perhaps you have the checklist that the household follows. Well, I'm a person who likes to have control of things. Hi, I'm Trevor. I like to have control of things. Yeah. I live and die by my work planner checklist, and I make sure that everything is crossed off at the end of every workday, and add in the things I need to do at home during the weekends. I have sticky notes to remind myself, a rule of life to make sure I take care of myself in the middle of it all, and I have found through this process that there is very little control in life. Seems like a little bit more when you're raising a toddler, but that just might be me. I think it's an important thought process when we contemplate what leading in the church can be like. I was reading the sections of today's required readings a while back, and it struck me that a lot of what it means to be a good leadership in a church, and what makes a good church in general, is how we handle people growing up. That can mean our kids and students, right, who are growing up physically, mentally, and emotionally. For the rest of us adults, that can be a little hard to handle. Probably 2-3 weeks ago, we were talking in staff meeting and remarking that 4 of our students here were going to be going into high school in the fall. And James just started shaking his head. He's like, no, they're still this tall. They're still little. I can't think about that. You know, we remember that when they were so tiny, how cute they used to be, right? Sometimes it also means handling how various people in our church are growing up spiritually. You know, perhaps they're taking things more seriously, or they're studying their Bible more. Maybe they're engaging in spiritual disciplines and have begun to lead others through those things. And I think where this can go awry is when new people, and particularly young people, start stepping up into leadership circles, because that can shake it up. Young people do things differently. They view the world differently because of what happened when they were growing up. Now, you might have already read your Bible this morning, so perhaps you can see where I'm going with this, but go ahead and turn in your Bibles with me to Deuteronomy 31. If you're new or new-ish, we've been reading through the Bible in a year, and we're almost finished here with Deuteronomy. There have been some growing pains for the Hebrew people as they have wandered through the desert for 40 years, but the end is in sight. The promised land, Canaan, will soon be upon them, and they'll take their inheritance as descendants of Abraham. If you remember all the way back in Genesis, their ancestor Abraham was promised 2 things in a covenant with God. That firstly, his descendants would be as plentiful as the stars in the sky, and that they would also, secondly, have an inheritance of land in this place called Canaan. Now, we don't believe that the number of descendants will be fulfilled until we see Christ return for us, as the book of Revelation, which is kind of the weird, scary one at the back that tells us how all this pans out, it shares with us that the amount of people who will be praising him at said return would not be able to be counted. So that's kind of off in the future sometime. Yet here we stand on the precipice for the Hebrew people. They've been hearing these stories for generations, living with the hope that God would deliver on his promise to them, giving them a land for themselves, a place to worship him and prosper as his people. And it had to be an exciting time to be a Hebrew. You know, I must imagine that there would be like a giddiness present here as they'd grown up with this anticipation and it was finally coming to fruition in their life. Could you imagine what that's like for a second? Have you had something like this? Well, I know for me, one that recently stuck out as I was preparing for this sermon was a concert that I'm going to in August. And I've told a few of you about this, so please bear with me. One thing that many of you might not know about me is that my favorite musical artist is by far Willie Nelson. I have been listening to his music for as long as I can remember. And while I'm not much of a concert person, it's always been on my bucket list to see Willie in concert. And by that, I mean the list is one person, and it's Willie Nelson. Lo and behold, after 28 years on this planet, I'm going to see Willie in concert. August, he's in Spokane. And I understand a little bit of this anticipation. This concert is months away, but I am giddy on the inside. Yeah. I'm sure many of you have a hard time thinking of me acting giddy on the outside, so we'll just leave it there. Now, for the Hebrews, this was much more important than their favorite musical act, right? This was a part of their faith, part of their DNA as a people, that they were seeing it come to fruition. But this exciting atmosphere isn't without a bittersweet tinge. So let's read our text for this morning, Deuteronomy chapter 31, verses 1 through 8. When Moses had finished giving these instructions to all the people of Israel, he said, "I am now 120 years old, and I am no longer able to lead you. The Lord has told me you will not cross the Jordan River, but the Lord your God himself will cross over ahead of you. He will destroy the nations living there, and you will take possession of their land. Joshua will lead you across the river, just as the Lord promised. The Lord will destroy the nations living in the land, just as he destroyed Sihon and Og, the king of the Amorites. The Lord will hand over to you the people who live there, and you must deal with them as I have commanded you. So be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid and do not panic before them, for the Lord your God will personally go ahead of you. He will neither fail you nor abandon you." Then Moses called for Joshua, and as all Israel watched, he said to him, "Be strong and courageous, for you will lead these people into the land that the Lord swore to their ancestors he would give them. You are the one who will divide it among them as their grants of land. Do not be afraid or discouraged, for the Lord will personally go ahead of you. He will be with you. He will neither fail you nor abandon you." Now, the tone going into this has been rather serious, not necessarily a joy killer, but one that helps the people calm their excitement just a tad. In the previous chapter, Moses had called them to remember the covenant between the people of Israel and God, what we now call the Mosaic Covenant, and it was summarized in God saying, "I will be their God, and they will be my people, on the conditions that they love me, obey me, and keep commit themselves to me." And so here Moses offers a somber note onto this. He's stepping down as their leader. He's giving the reason of his age and health that he can no longer fill this role for the people. Now, in the scheme of the Pentateuch, which is the fancy Greek word for the first five books of the Old Testament, Moses is on the older side at this point, right? Earlier in the book of Genesis, we see names like Noah and Methuselah, who lived over 900 years, but for the time frame, Moses is 120, and that seems to be a ripe old age. And more than this, they were at a point in their journey where Moses could not go further. While for the most part, he was a good leader, Moses was not without flaw, and he made his own personal bungles, I think is the theological term. When he followed God and when he led people. And these slip-ups, these sins, were something that kept him from entering the land promised to the people of Israel. Instead, Joshua, who had a pretty good track record as a leadership voice for the Israelites, was going to lead the group across the Jordan River, help lead them into what God had for the people. They also had the promise that God would go before the group, kind of pave the way for them to take hold of the land that was their inheritance if they honored what he asked of them. And I want us to take a moment and just pause here and have us ponder a little bit what this must have felt like for everyone involved. Let's try to step into the shoes of each little group here. Moses must be absolutely gutted to share this with the people. He's poured his heart and his soul into the Israelites, fulfilling the call that God placed on his life to be their leader. And it's difficult for a leader to successfully bring a group through one major change, but Moses brought them through a handful with grace, mostly. He led them through the liberation from Egypt. He received the law from God and relayed it to the people, orchestrating boundaries for life and faith for the Hebrews. He led them through the wilderness, brought them to the precipice of promise, the Jordan River, where they would cross into Canaan. And those are just the big ones, by the way. He had small ones, too, like the golden calf incident, the rebellion in Numbers 14, where the Israelites firstly wanted to kill Moses and Aaron, but when Joshua and Caleb spoke up, they also said they wanted to kill Joshua and Caleb, which I bet Joshua hasn't forgotten that. There was Korah's rebellion, where the earth split open and swallowed people, and the rebels were burned with fire and a plague. This is a lot to be carried on the shoulders of one leader. And again, he had a few bungles. He also knew that this day would come when he would not be able to accompany all the people that he had grown close with over the decades that he was their leader. These were his friends, his contemporaries, I'm guessing his kids. Yet I wonder in this moment how many people knew that Moses wasn't going to be with them when they went into the land of inheritance. I would hope that he had told the inner circle at least. You know, I imagine that Joshua knew since he was stepping into the role after Moses. Maybe Caleb knew since he was sort of the part of that inner circle of leadership. It's my hunch that he probably told them, as there would be a fair amount of shame that might go with it. That's maybe why he didn't broadcast to all of the people. Because who knows who would have been angry or how they would have reacted, you know. For him, for Moses, I'm sure that he was rejoicing with them and that his friends were able to take their inheritance. But for him personally, this probably had to be kind of a bittersweet, a sad moment. Now, for the people, the Israelites, if they knew this transition of leadership was coming, they probably would be sad, and they certainly grieved that later on. Yet if they didn't know, that had to be a jarring announcement. After all of this, everything's excited and then breaks, pulling the e-brake there. Let's get a little deeper into this. Let's throw a curveball here. What would you think if I stood up here today and I told you that James was stepping down and I was taking his place? I appreciate that. That's not happening. That's not happening. I could call James, and he could tell you over the phone, but he's on a plane right now, heading back here. But it got your heart up a little bit, hearing that, didn't it? It might not be anything to do with my qualification to lead a church, or even me personally, but it's more about James being the guy, right? He's been here for 18 years, and he's walked with you all faithfully. And he's been present. And if you didn't know an announcement like that was coming and it was for real, it would be a shock. And I'm trying to decide here for the Israelites how they would have reacted to this news of Moses stepping away from leading them. You know, maybe they were like that, where they're like, yeah, let's go, Joshua, awesome. Or maybe you just could have heard a pin drop, where they're just, what? Maybe you heard contingencies of people yelling, no! Or what? Or just say it ain't so, Moses. I don't know. At any rate, there's a big change here. They're about to enter a series of conflicts with the people in the land of Canaan, but also as they take their inheritance as the people of God. Now, lastly, let's think about Joshua for a second. Joshua had faithfully served under Moses and served the people of Israel in leadership for some time, but he's roughly 40 to 50 years younger than Moses at this point. And I got to think that had to be hard to swallow too. You know, for me, That would be like if I stepped down from my position today and tomorrow any of our eighth grade students took my place, like McCade or Tessa or Tane or Juliana, right? I would be a little scared for that. And I'm guessing that they would also be scared. They're like, I don't know what I'm doing. The people here, and seeing this for Joshua, they had to probably feel that for him. I'm sure that he was scared stepping into the shoes of Moses. I want to pause here. I'm no Moses. If any of our students replaced me, that's not what they would be stepping into. But Joshua here, he's got really big shoes to fill. And the people are going to think about how Moses led, and they're going to apply it to him, whether he likes it or not. You know, he's younger. He thinks differently. He leads differently. And they're about to get into some tough stuff when they cross the Jordan River, and that's going to be a lot to handle for them. So as the assembly is standing right here, listening to all this in real time, I'm wondering if Joshua isn't thinking, I better not mess this up. I better not mess it up. That's how I would feel, filling the shoes of someone like Moses. We've stepped into the shoes of the people involved here, but a few questions remain. The first question is, how do we apply this to now? Well, I think that we can all agree that the American church is not so strong in what we call leadership development. It's typical of American churches to have a strong, committed leadership of older folks with limited younger people stepping up. And from a newer perspective to First Church, I would say that we're moving in the right direction. But the fact remains that a lot of churches out there aren't investing into young leaders in the ways that they should. You know, this is a story I was telling Don Miriam, our facilities pillar, about my son Felix and how it helped me think about leadership. During the Christmas season, we received one of those boxes that has like summer sausage and crackers and cheese and a few other delectables in there. I love those boxes. And one of the things in that box was a tiny jar of honey. And that tiny jar of honey was like the one thing out of the box that we didn't use for a while. So it sat in our little kitchen island for a couple months. Until my son discovered it. And he's all about figuring out new things, and he's a tiny guy, so he wanted a tiny jar of honey, and that seems rational. And in the moment, I gave him this small jar thinking, well, he can just carry it around the house and look at it, and I'll just keep an eye out on him. He's not strong enough to get the lid off, so it shouldn't be a problem. Now, I looked away for 30 seconds, and I'm convinced that that's how most horror stories start, with a toddler. But he took that little jar of honey into his room, in the middle of his rug, and somehow, by using his insane toddler strength, just muscled that thing off and dumped the entire contents on himself and on his rug.
Did you take pictures?
I did not take pictures. It's in cleanup mode. Yeah. But because the jar was so small, there wasn't a huge mess, but it was one of those judgment calls as a parent that didn't pan out. And the way I relate this to leadership is that sometimes we give younger generations responsibility that they're not quite ready for yet. And we try not to make them feel too bad, you know, when they mess it up a little bit. You know, we say, you broke a few eggs. It happens. Everything will be fine. The issue that I've seen in a handful of churches, though, is that we start to see every opportunity for that leadership development, for that greater responsibility for younger folks, like that little jar of honey that I gave my son. I'm a little more suspicious of handing my son things like that now that can be spilled. I don't like to hand him cups that don't have lids or containers like the one I gave him with the honey. But that's not very fair, is it? It doesn't give him the opportunity to grow and learn from mistakes. And as a dad, I needed to be okay, and I need to be okay with my son spilling a little bit of milk or spilling a little bit of honey or food or whatever, so he learns how to handle a cup and drink from it. I need to be okay with him learning what positive and negative consequences are to this his little life experiments, right? In the same way, those of us who've been in the church for a while, me included, need to be okay with handing off responsibility and leadership to those who might not have as much experience or life lived so they can grow and learn. Now, on the opposite side of this, there's some trepidation from the younger crowd, because maybe they feel sentiments like Timothy in the New Testament, where they might think that others will look down on them for being young and in leadership. But the fact remains that to the younger folks in the room, we need you. We need you just as much as we need anyone else in the church. And I'm not just talking to the young parents or the younger people in our congregation. I'm talking to our kids and students. If you see ways the church can grow in how it approaches people and how we do ministry, or you have thoughts about the Bible and what we believe, share those things. We want to hear those things from you because our church is better for it. When you share who you are and your gifts and you serve the body. I mean, we had a testament to that on Easter. We're extremely blessed by that display of your giftings. And even if there are ways that you think you could take on more responsibility, we want to help move you in that direction. So here's the message I want both parties in this church to hear. Be strong and courageous. Let's read again how Moses puts this to the Israelites and to Joshua. He just says, the Lord will destroy the nations living in the land just as he destroyed Sihon and Og, the kings of the Amorites. The Lord will hand over to you the people who live there, and you must deal with them as I have commanded you. So be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid and do not panic before them, for the Lord your God will personally go ahead of you. He will neither fail you nor abandon you. For those who have held leadership for some time, be strong and courageous. To release a little bit of the reins, to let go of a little control so you can invest in younger folks and push forward the mission of the church into the next generation. There's some fear that can come with that, but I share the same sentiment that Moses shared with the people of Israel. Don't be afraid. Instead, be strong and courageous to share your gifts and your knowledge and experience with those who haven't had those experiences yet. They don't have the life to know what you know or how to lead a church. Be strong and courageous. For those who haven't held leadership or have had limited chances to do so, the word for you is to be strong and courageous too, to share your gifts and to step into leadership circles. And this might be intimidating since others have done it a long time and do it so well. There might even be big shoes to fill. That doesn't mean that you can't have a hand in leading a church and growing the church in different ways than those who have walked this road before you. That was certainly the case for Joshua. While he had big shoes to fill, the situations that he encountered as the leader of the Israelites were drastically different than what Moses did. There can be overlap to this. There can be new territories to explore. Final question that we have to ask here is, where's Jesus? Well, if you see verses 6 and 8, you'll understand. All the things that God calls us to, whether it's individually or in the church, have the promise, firstly, that God goes before us. You know, I play a game with some friends on Saturday afternoons called Dungeons and Dragons. And we call a character like this a tank. The tank runs into the fray first. They run into the conflict first, and they guard everyone more vulnerable from getting hurt. And God does that for us. He's the one who leads the way. He shows the safest and best path. We also get the promise that he won't leave or forsake his people. He's going to lead the way, and he'll be a constant for us as we seek to learn and grow more into what the people of God were intended to be. And when we think about what it means to lead the church and guide new people into leadership, it helps us understand that leadership as it is was never intended to be us carrying all of the load, but us doing the most we can to help God with what he's doing in the world at large and in our churches. That's a strong and courageous thing for a strong and courageous God. So as we follow him, let's be strong and courageous too. God, we love you. And we thank you for stories like this from the Old Testament where we see things that we experience now. Leadership changes and learning that you can't fill certain roles anymore, or you need to step back and for others to step up. That when scary things like this arise, it's important for us to know that you're there that you're going before us and leading us, whether it's stepping back or stepping forward. We love you, God, and we appreciate our time with you this morning in your name. Amen. Coming to a time of communion here.